My name is Alicia Sell. Today is the 12th of June, 2007, and I am interviewing Mr. Robert Allen Garland at his home on Lakewood Drive. And thank you for joining us today, Mr. Garland.
A pleasure to be here with you.
Okay. And I'm going to start out by asking you some background questions about yourself, just some biographical information.
Okay.
Can you tell us when and where were you born?
I was born on February the 3rd, 1923, at 373 Walnut Avenue Southwest in Roanoke, Virginia.
Okay. And, let's see. So you were born here and you were born on Walnut Avenue.
Correct.
At home.
At home, right.
Okay. What were your parents' names?
My father was Walter Berman Garland, and my mother was Minnie Allen Garland.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I had an older brother. He was a junior, Walter B. Garland Jr. He was 4 years older than me. He was born in 1919. And my younger brother, Ray Lucian Garland, L-U-C-I-A-N, was born on May the 20th, 1934.
So just the three boys.
Correct.
Did you have any extended family living nearby to you here in Roanoke?
My uncle and he had one child. Yes, several of my father's siblings lived here. He was the youngest of that family, which I think was about eight. But I know he had several brothers that lived here from time to time, and three of his sisters. So the family grew up in Buchanan, and they kind of migrated to Roanoke, and some of them lived here from the time they arrived here, probably in early 1900s, until they died.
And so your father was born in Buchanan, Virginia?
Yes, yes.
Where was your mother from?
My mother was born in Goochland County, which is out in the country, approximately 50 miles, I guess, from Richmond at that time.
What did your mother and father do for a living?
Well, my father, after they were married, they were married on October the 25th, 1915, and they moved to Roanoke. And my father went to work for a drugstore, which was then on the corner of Camel Avenue and Randolph Street. At Randolph Street is now Williamson Road. He went to work there behind the soda fountain, and then finally bought half interest in the store from a Mr. Clor. The store was originally known as Clor's Pharmacy, and then Clor and Garland, and then my father bought out Mr. Clor, I believe in the early 20s, and then he owned that store until it was closed in 1950, in the early 50s.
Did your father have any trouble with business during the Depression?
Oh, yes. Story that I gave you about the market area tells much about the Depression era. And, yes, it was very difficult, and it was a little drugstore compared to the ones today, and during the Depression, he was able to make it, but it was difficult. And I can remember going down there as a child, a young child, and later as a teenager. And it wasn't downtown Roanoke at that time was not very brisk. It was not much business downtown, but most of the business that people did in those days was done downtown. The marketing and the purchasing because there was no shopping centers. The Grandin Road area was about the only shop, and the Crystal Spring area. There were small business areas at that time, but no massive business, you know, like shopping malls that you have today.
Can you describe your house that you grew up in Walnut Avenue, for instance? Was it one story or two? Was it brick?
Of course, I lived there for only 2 years, okay. My first 2 years. I think it must have been a duplex because my father's brother and his wife, and they had one child, they lived there along with my older brother and my mother and father. So it must have been, I think it was a two-story house. It has since been torn down, so I can't really tell you much about it because I, of course, was only two when we moved from there.
What is the house? What street did you grow up on most of your life?
Belleville Road.
Belleville.
Yeah.
What was your house like on Belleville?
Belleville Road was a very nice. It was a new house when we moved in, and I lived there from 1925 until I went to school. I went to Fork Union Military Academy in 1939. And so I lived there during that period, which would have been 14 years. And it was a very pleasant neighborhood and still is. In fact, that home is still in the Garland family. My older brother, Dickie, who became a physician, and his wife and three children, live there, and she's, and the widow, Eloise, still lives there. So the house has been in the Garland family from 1925 until the present.
And is that a two-story house?
It's a two-story house. It had only one bathroom. It had three bedrooms on the second floor and a sleeping porch. In those days, and my mother and father were great believers in sleeping porches, even in the wintertime and the cold time. We slept out there because they had the feeling that fresh air and cold was, you know, a healthy environment.
So would you and your brothers all sleep out
in
the sleeping porch?
Yeah, I can remember sleeping there, and they would, the temperature in the dead of winter, and it would be, you know, probably in the 20s or even below in sometime. But we would always sleep out there, and my mother would fix a hot water bottle for our feet. It would get cold during the night, of course. But we slept there. I would imagine we had stacks, as I remember, stacks of blankets on us in cold weather.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. We slept there all, as I remember, all during my childhood. We, of course, was no air conditioning. We slept out there. It was no heat in this, on the sleeping porch. But that was the way people lived. I would imagine most homes built during that period probably all had sleeping porches on it. This house doesn't, but I think those houses built from 1900 to the 30s, probably most of them had sleeping porches.
And was that on the first store, the first floor?
No. No, sleeping porch was on the second floor in the back of the house. And your hallway, then the bathroom, then the three bedrooms came off the hallway, and the sleeping porch was in the rear of the house.
Okay.
Had a door from the hallway to the sleeping porch. So during the winter time, of course, they would shut the doors so the cold air wouldn't come into the rest of the house. And the house was originally heated, I remember, by coal. And then in the early 30s, when oil furnaces first came out, my father had an oil furnace installed. And that was really an innovation at that time, because when you had coal, somebody had to shovel coal into the furnace, and you had to order coal from the coal company, and you had to have a big bin to keep the coal in the basement. So that the oil furnace was a very convenient utility for that period, during that period. Because most of the homes in Roanoke, up until the 30s, I would imagine most of them had coal.
What kind of chores did you have around your house?
Well, I can't say that I had any regulated number of chores, but my mother, we had a colored maid, that live-in maid, that stayed there, and so she helped my mother with her name was Katie. She came to work for us when she was only 12 years old. In those days, the Bronx City would assign these orphans to homes like ours, and they got a small salary, but they lived there for, you know, room and board and all. So Katie was there. She was kind of a nanny for me from late 20s up until my younger brother. Then she was kind of a nanny for him. That's what they would call them now. I don't remember us calling her, because she was just like a member of the family at that time. But she took care of my younger brother until she left us, which was probably around 1937 or so. She would take him down to Grandin Road in the baby carriage. And that's when all the maids, where the families had babies, they would gather there on Grandin Road, right approximately where my drugstore was later. And they would, I guess, compare babies and talk and all right there on the corner. And sometimes, I can remember, there would be 8 or 10 baby carriages lined up there on the corner. And Katie would take Petey, that was his nickname, Petey, and they would all gather there, particularly on summer afternoons, you know, when the weather was good.
Okay.
But she lived there with us from the late, sometime in the 20s. I can barely remember her coming there. And she left there, I think, in about 37 or 38, right along in that period. So she lived there all during that time. She had her own room, and I know what my father paid her was very small, because, you know, it wasn't a lot of money then in those days. But she lived well there with us, because we furnished all our clothing and room and board and everything.
Did she keep in contact with your family after she had left, or?
No, she died.
Oh, okay.
She died shortly after she left us.
Okay.
And she had some relatives out in West Virginia, and she wanted to go out there. I think she was pregnant. That's the reason she left us. She would have been probably in her early 20s at that time. And I believe she was pregnant, and she went out there to have the baby, and she died during childbirth.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the way it happened.
Okay. Well, let's talk
Am I going in too much detail?
No, you're fine. You're fine. Okay. Let's talk about your education a little bit. Where did you go to elementary school and high school?
Well, the first 2 years, and it was changed shortly thereafter. Woodrow Wilson had just opened. So the first 2 years, the first and second grade, I went to Woodrow Wilson. That was a junior high school. Now, I can't explain why, because the other students were all junior high school, why they would mix. Evidently, it had something to do with the crowded conditions at Virginia Heights. But anyway, the first 2 years was at Woodrow Wilson, the first and second grades. And then the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade was at Virginia Heights Elementary School. And then we went back to Woodrow for the seventh. In those years, and I think it must have had something to do with the Depression or trying to get kids out so they could work, they eliminated the eighth grade, so they didn't have an eighth grade. So the Woodrow Wilson, I spent the seventh, skipped the eighth, was eliminated, then the ninth and the tenth was a Woodrow. And then the Jefferson High School for the 11th grade. And then I went to Fork Union Military Academy for a year and a half and graduated there in 1940.
During eighth grade, what did you do since you were not in school?
Oh, we were in school.
Oh, okay.
We just went from the seventh to the ninth grade. They just eliminated it, like it wasn't there. No, we weren't out of school. I didn't mean that.
Okay.
Other words, we instead of going 12 years, we only went 11.
Okay.
See? So actually, that meant, unlike today, it would be you'd be getting out of school a year sooner in those days as opposed to now. Other words, you would graduate at 17 rather than 18, like it is today.
And you said you went to Jefferson and then to...
I went to Jefferson for probably a year or so. And then I went to Fork Union Military Academy. I was there for about a year and a half.
Where is that located?
It's towards Richmond. It's about 60-something miles from Richmond. It's in Fluvanna County. It was a... like a prep school, you know. And I graduated there in 1940.
And where did you go to college after that?
I went to college, the medical college, School of Pharmacy, September of 1940. Was there from September of 40 until I went in the Army in March of 1943. Then I returned. Then I was in the Army from March of 43 till March of 1946. Then went back to the medical college in September of 1946, and then graduated in June of 1949.
And what was your degree in?
Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy.
Did your brothers both, did they go to college as well?
Oh, yes. My older brother, he went to VMI from 1936 to 1940, graduated. He went to the University of Virginia Medical School for a year. And then he dropped out, I believe, and taught at Stanton Military Academy. He got married after he went to college, and he taught at Stanton Military Academy for a year, and then he was called into the Army and served in the Army Air Corps. He was a meteorologist, and then I went on to flight school. And he was in the Army, I think, until 1946. And then he returned to the University of Virginia Medical School in 46 and graduated in 1950 from the medical school, University of Virginia Medical School. And then he came back here and he interned over here, what was then Roanoke Memorial and Crippled Children's Hospital, what they called it in those days, because that's where all the polio patients came. In fact, his year of internship, they had a polio epidemic. They called it infantile paralysis at that time. He was an intern over there during that period. It was they wouldn't let him go home or anything. So he was there on duty tending to what they did. They shipped from all southwestern Virginia, and they had an epidemic, I think, up in Withville and up in that area. They transferred all of those patients to the Roanoke Memorial and Crippled Children's Hospital. That's what it was known as at that time. That was because of the fact that all the cases of polio were transferred there. And they, in those days, they put them in what called the iron lung. That's how they could continue breathing. And so he interned there, and then later opened a practice in Southeast, and he practiced there for maybe 10 years, and then it was just too much for him, and he finally had to give it up.
Was education important to your family? Was it expected that you would go to school?
All of us, all three of us, I got one degree only, but my brother, the older brother, he got a degree from BMI, then a medical degree. And then while he was in the service, he got a degree in meteorology. Then he became a pilot. He was a very smart boy. And he, after he came back and was practicing, and then he gave up his practice, I think he got a master's degree. But he had about 3 or 4 degrees. Mm-hmm. Then my younger brother, he went to Roanoke College and University of Virginia. I believe he has 2 degrees. So I'm the one with only 1 degree. But we were all expected to, you know, to go to college.
Okay. Let's see. What was your home life like? For instance, what did you do in the evenings? What, did you listen to the radio a lot?
We did. Of course, there was no television. But We were very active there on Belleville Road. It was a lovely neighborhood. The neighbors were all nice. They had a lot of children in that neighborhood. It's the type of neighborhood that, you know, you wouldn't lock your doors or anything like that. And in the summers, we would play baseball, softball, either in the street there on Belleville Road or in the backyard of our house. We had a ping pong table in our basement. We'd have ping pong tournaments. I remember it was probably 35 approximately. That was when the game Monopoly came out. And one of the neighbors got the game, and we would spend literally hours all day. And we would go down early in the morning, play Monopoly all day long, and we'd go home for lunch, go home for supper, and we'd play it until late at night. late in the night, and you see, you got to remember that was during the Depression, and you were handling this toy money, and so it made them feel like powerful because nobody had any money to speak of.
Would adults play it also?
No, it was the children. We would have four or five children playing all day long, practically. And that summer, there's no telling how many hours we spent just playing Monopoly. At night, I remember, summer nights, we would play, a game called, Capture the Flag. That was the name of it. And, the idea of the game, I can't remember it exactly. The idea of the game was the end of each block was the person was supposed to be guarding the flag. And the object, you would choose upside, the object was to try to capture the flag from the other team's flag. See? And then we played that many nights. Because you could hide in the bushes and so forth. Then there was a game called Kick the Can. I can't remember exactly how that was played, but it had something to do with you could run and try to kick the cans from the others from getting it and that sort of thing. But we played a lot of softball, and we usually wound up playing in the street because there wasn't much traffic. And the trees that lined the Belleville there, they were kind of the bases, and then you'd have something there for the second base home plate. But we played a lot of baseball. And also in our backyard, we played some baseball. But then we had on our garage, we had a basketball hoop, and we played basketball there. We choose upside teams, and we play basketball. So we had very active summer, and we had a cousin on my mother's side, my first cousin. Her sister's boy would come up here every summer and spend the summer with us from Richmond, and live there with us during the summer. And he would play the games with us, of course. But it was a very nice neighborhood to grow up in. And when it snowed, I remember, of course, in those days, the streets, particularly the side streets, would not be cleared. If you had a big snow, we would have sleds. And we get at the far end, the upper end of Belleville Road, and we could sleigh ride all the way down to old approximately our house. It was a nice neighborhood to grow up in. The neighbors, the children were all well-behaved children. I can't remember any problems. I mean, drugs would be unheard of in those days.
What kind of businesses did your family shop at?
I mentioned some of that in one of those articles that I think went on the market. But all the meat, mostly. See, of course, you didn't have these supermarkets. They in the city market building. There were butchers lined up on both sides. What you have today is those retail lunch outlets. Well, in those days, there were butchers lined up on both sides. I would say, probably 12 or 15 butchers. And my mother would go in there and buy whatever meat we needed for the week, I believe. And then the produce, the produce was purchased there on the market. The vendors were on each side of the market at the sidewalk. And the vendors were all lined up on both sides. I think it was one that had seafood, I believe. Sold seafood, Kelly's, I believe it was, or Parker's maybe too. But my mother would buy her fresh vegetables and fruits from those vendors on the outside of the market. They were covered, but they were on the walkway where you could just walk down and buy and see all the vegetables, fruits and all. And she would buy the fruits and vegetables from them. And then there was a little mom and pop store, which that's what it would be considered today. It's down in that block where my father had a drugstore, and that's where she bought, you know, her staples like coffee and sugar and stuff like that.
Were there clothing retailers downtown, or how did you get your clothes?
Oh, yeah. That, at one time, I would say downtown Roanoke had 10 or 12 men's stores, sold nothing but men's clothing, and more than that of women's clothing. They had these shops, Learners had shops, but I can remember like Davidson's. Davidson was down there then. And there was John Norman and all. I counted them one day. It seemed like to me it was about 12. That's all they sold was men's. They had one men's shop that sold nothing but hats, but Learners and some of the other, they had Spiegel's, Foreman. Then, of course, Hieronymus. There were two, at that time, there were two department stores, Hieronymus and another one, independent. Well, Hieronymus was independent then. N.W. Pugh. They were on the corner of, you know, where the old grand piano building.
Yes.
Yeah. N.W. Pugh was in that building.
Okay.
That was a department store, locally owned. And then Hieronymus originally was on the other corner. And then Hieronymus later moved from there up to on the corner of Church and Jefferson.
Okay.
You know, where that building still has Hieronymus.
Yeah, it still has the
but
title
title. When during the 30s, and I think on up into the 40s and maybe into the 50s, their store was on the corner of Campbell Avenue and Henry Street, or First Street. That was Hieronymus. Then across the street was N.W. Pugh, and they were very well-run department stores. And they were both locally owned. The Pugh family, they owned that. And they operated that up until probably into the 60s. They closed that. And, of course, when Hieronymus moved, then, were you here when Millen Rhodes was here? Okay. When Hieronymus moved to Jefferson Street, then Millen Rhodes, that's the department store that had headquarters in Richmond, they seemed like they tore that building down and built a new building right there on the corner of Camel and Henry Street. That was Millen Rhodes. And they, when the shopping centers opened, both Hieronymus and Millen Rhodes would have stores like on Melrose Avenue, Towers, Crossroads. They'd have stores in those shopping centers.
So it kind of put Pugh's out of business?
Yeah, yeah. It was just, but Pugh's, during the time I was growing up, they did a very good business. My mother shopped there a lot, I know. And at Christmas time, they had what they would have with Santa Claus, what they call Pugh's Toy Land. And it seemed like it was on the second or third floor. And they had a big toy department during Christmas. But when Christmas was over, they took that space for something else. I mean, in those days, toys weren't like they are today, kind of a year-round business. In those days, most toys were bought December, you know, for Christmas, mm-hmm. for Santa Claus. But that was a very, I know, growing up, we would go to Pugh's Toyland and look at all the toys.
How did you travel about in Roanoke? How did you get to the stores? Did your family have a car?
Oh, yeah. We had, but one car. It was like on Belleville Road. I don't think anybody had over one car. But some of those families had no cars, you know, in those days. But Roanoke had was very fortunate to have a very good streetcar system. And then after that, buses, they integrated, they had streetcars first, then buses and streetcars, and the streetcars were discontinued, and then they had nothing but buses. But when I was growing up, I used a streetcar a lot. If I went down to my father's drugstore or went to a movie, see, all the Grand Inn Theater was the only theater that was outside of the business district. All the other, there were four. There was the Rialto, the American, the Park, the Roanoke, and the Jefferson. There were five that I can remember. And I'm sure before that was probably more. But there were five movie theaters all during the 30s, the 40s. Then they started closing them in the 50s, and now there are none. The last one, I remember I attended the last movie show, took my parents, the American, there. They were there. I don't guess you would have been here then. No, you wouldn't. The American Theater was, you know, where the First National Exchange Bank is, mm-hmm. right on the corner. The American Theater was, they tore that down. They built that Dominion, that 12-story building where the American Theater was. And the American Theater, then the Rialto, which showed basically nothing but Western movies. That's where we went. As a child, we went to a lot of the Western movies. And then there was a Park Theater. Jefferson was up on Jefferson. Park and Jefferson were up on Jefferson. Then there was a Roanoke Theater. But there was, at one time, there were five that I can remember in downtown Roanoke.
Did they just show movies or did they do plays too? Live plays?
During my time, I don't think, the Roanoke Theater did show some, they did have some vaudeville acts, and magicians would come to Roanoke, and they would show, they would appear on the stage. But Roanoke had the Academy of Music. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Have you? Okay. That was located there on Salem Avenue at about 4th Street. It's below 5th Street there. It was a shame that the city council allowed that to be torn down because it was built in the 1890s. And that's where the vaudeville, the operas, the plays, and those sort of things.
Would your parents go out in the evening to those kinds of shows?
They would on occasion. I can remember attending the... It was torn down in 1953. I don't know why the preservationists and the historians allowed it to happen. But the city council, they claimed that the building was unsafe. So the city council voted and they tore it down. But that was, they said it had one of the best acoustics of any of those theaters that were built during that period. I can remember going there. There was a, my brother was at BMI during 36 and 40. They came out with a play about BMI. It was written by a former student of BMI. It's called Brother Rat. It was a play originally. And I remember going to the Academy of Music. They had a performance there at the Academy of Music, Brother Rat. That was later converted to a movie, and Ronald Reagan was in that movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan was in that movie. In fact, my brother was at BMI when they were filming that. So it was in 38 or 39 long. And that's where Reagan met his first wife during that movie. But they did a lot of the filming there at BMI. Reagan was one of the... He was, of course, a young actor at that time, but Eddie Albert was in it, Bracken was in it, I remember, it was a very popular movie, of course, around here because of VMI, but it was a shame that would have been a real landmark if it had kept it. Because it had those box seats. It reminded you of like the Ford's Theater up in Washington, you know, or in Lincoln. That's what it reminded you of. It's kind of built like that.
Let's talk a little bit about... once you came back from college, what kind of work you did throughout your life?
Okay. I graduated in June 1949. At that time, my father had, I think, about 10 small drugstores throughout the city. They were all, there were two of the stores were downtown. One on Camel was in this article that you got. There was another one on the corner of Jefferson Street and Salem. Then the others were scattered throughout the city in the residential area. One was on Grandin Road there in that business area. So when I got out of college, I went to the store on Grandin Road and opened a prescription department. At that time, it was just a kind of a patent medicine store. So at that time, when I came back, we opened a prescription department in that store. And that would have been in September of 49. And I operated at that location until 52. Then we purchased the land across the street. There was a home on it. We had to tear down the home. And we built the store, what is now Independent Pharmacy. Are you familiar with Grandin Road?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was across the street from the old store, that building where the bank is. There originally was a bank. Then the drugstore, that's where we were. And then there was a flower shop on the corner. And we moved there from across the street in 1952. And, in fact, Valentine's Day, we opened on Valentine's Day of 1953. And I operated that store. We enlarged it several times, extended it back, built a restaurant upstairs, and operated that store until March the 1st, 1969, when I sold that store to a drug chain. And then I went to work for, well, I worked some at People's Drugstore, but I finally settled, and I think it was 1970 or 71. I went to Friendship Manor and became the director of pharmacy out there and remained there until I retired in 1989, I guess. And since then, I've helped out at various places. I worked some at the health department, some at Wonder Drug in Southeast, and Free Clinic I've worked since then.
What happened to your, did you just run the one store on Grand?
Yes.
On Grand,
yes.
And then you didn't ever run the rest of your father's stores?
No. They, you know, as these big chains started coming in, they just closed them one by one. Two of the stores, one there on Jefferson Street, the Viaduct came in, so they had to tear that building down. There was one of the stores, and then another one was there on Jefferson and Walnut, and the expressway came in. That building had to be torn down. So one by one, they closed. So we have no drugstore now. I think the last one was closed in the 70s sometime.
And through the whole time that you ran your drugstore on Grandin, was it just a pharmacy? You had mentioned that it was a restaurant.
Oh, yeah, it was a restaurant. We had a soda fountain downstairs. From the beginning, it was a soda fountain downstairs. Then we enlarged that. We took in the area that was occupied by the flower shop. That was all converted into a restaurant and soda fountain. And then upstairs, we took in that space, all of that space, and converted that into a restaurant. It's called the Gaslight. That was more of an upscale type, where the soda fountains all sit down, booths and tables, and the kitchen was one end of it.
So did you have someone run the restaurant for you then?
Oh, yes. We had a manager upstairs and downstairs.
So you did good business
through
that.
Yeah. At one time, we probably served, probably at least 1,000 people a day there, because we opened at 6 o'clock, and we started serving breakfast. We would serve, that was downstairs, we would serve about 300 breakfasts every day.
Wow.
And then we had three meals. We had cooks. We made our own pastry, bread, salad. We made all that stuff. And today, we were doing about $1,000 a day in lunch business and food business. But today, that would be probably $8,000 or $10,000, you know, today's prices.
Mm-hmm.
But was, we had a real good reputation of serving very good food. You got to remember too, this was before McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and all of those. See, we served hamburgers, hot dogs, sandwiches. Then we had full meal, blue plate specials, breakfast we'd serve. In other words, you could come in there and get eggs cooked any way you wanted, sausage, bacon, ham. It was a gathering place for that area, but you had no 7-Eleven stores and all that sort of thing like you do today. We probably wouldn't be able to do that much business today, but you could come in there and get a Coca-Cola if that's all you wanted, or an ice cream cone, or a hamburger, or a hot dog, or a full plate or salad plate. We had, well, we employed in the restaurant, we probably had about 50 people. Dishwashers, busboys, cooks.
It's a big business.
Oh, yeah. Waitresses. We could seat all together upstairs and downstairs, around 225 people. But the advantage of that, in other words, if we were filled up upstairs, we would have a lot of times during the lunch or dinner hours, we would have people waiting to get in. If they weren't busy if they had some vacancies downstairs, we could send people downstairs or vice versa. We could send them up and down. We had an elevator there in the store where they could go up and down. But it was quite an experience. But it was taking, I probably averaged 100 hours a week.
Wow.
Working. But I managed it. I never had any illness to speak of, other than maybe a cold or something like that. So I managed very well.
You were also very active in the community. Tell us a little bit about like the boards served on and stuff like that.
The one evening, I think it was, the chairman of the Republican committee happened to come in the drugstore. He was drinking coffee up there at the restaurant, and I walked in. I guess I knew him. I sat down. And he said, you know, you ought to, this was probably about 1961. He said, you ought to run for city council. And I had never been in politics. I didn't know anything about it because I had spent all my time, you know, working. And I said, well, I don't know anything about city government. And he kept on. He came back, I think, once or twice. And finally, I said, well, I'll run. So the Republican Party nominated me, and I did win. Mayor Stoller, he ran, and Jimmy Jones, they ran. But I was the only Republican. So I took a seat on city council in would have been September of 1962, and I had a 4-year term. And when the 4 years was up, I was just so busy at the drugstore and all, I had all I could do, plus city council at that time. I decided I would not run in 66. So I sold the store in 69. So after I sold the store, then I ran again in 1970. Then I stayed there from 1970 until 1990. I was on council. So I was on council, city council, for a total of 24 years.
Wow.
And it was a good experience for me. I learned a lot about city government, and of course, went to a lot of banquets, political meetings, and all this sort of thing during that period.
And you also served on the Library Advisory Board, was that correct?
When we built the, this would have been in the, my first term. In fact, I have some pictures here somewhere. And the program. Of course, Raleigh Court did not have any. People had petitioned the city council to build a library in Raleigh Court. So they presented that petition to the city council. And I was appointed, as since I was living here, at that time I was here. I was living in this area, as was most of the council. In those days, practically all the council members lived in the Southwest. And, in fact, I think all seven of us lived in the Southwest at that time. But anyway, I was appointed chairman of the committee to study about the Raleigh Court location of the library. And so, I've forgotten exactly the details, but anyway, we decided on the location, that the present location of the library, and Julian Hurst was the city manager at that time. He was on the committee, and I think Mayor Stoller, there's about four people on the committee, and I was chairman of the committee. So, of course, we got the land. Well, the land belonged to the city at that time. That was before. I can't remember whether Patrick Henry was built at that time. Anyway, if it was built, it would be very new. Maybe it was built already. But anyway, the city owned the land, so we didn't have to worry about the land. So we put the bid out for the library. The plans were drawn by an architect and so forth. And we accepted the bid and built the library. And gosh, we were able to do all of that. You wouldn't be able to do it now in such a short period of time. I think the whole process took less than a year.
Wow.
From the beginning to the time it was finished. And we had one stumbling block. The matter of the floor. I wanted carpet on the floor. And the reason I wanted carpet is because I thought it would reduce the sound. People walking. The city manager, he said, "Oh, it's going to be too hard to clean. And people would be spilling stuff, and walking through there and mud and so on." So he wanted tile. So we had a big to do over that. But I was voted down. He won that argument, which I always regretted. And so they had tile. What is it now? Is it tile now?
I think it is still tile.
Is it still tile? But I was in favor of the carpet. But I couldn't. I seemed like I had one other person, but he had two others, as I recall, that were in favor of going with his logic. That it was much easier to clean the tile than it would be the carpet. And so that's how I was involved in that. But I always regretted that we didn't get the carpet.
Maybe I think they'll get the carpet, and when they redo
it. Yeah, when they redo it, I expect they will in those days.
Yeah.
They have, of course, in those days, they didn't have carpet like the, you know, they got the outdoor carpet and all kinds of carpet now. And I guess Jugan Hurst, he was thinking they won't be spending too much time cleaning that carpet, which may have been the case. I don't know. But I was thinking of the serenity and the quietness of the library. And that's the reason I wanted the carpet.
I think I would have voted with you.
Yeah.
Your house here on Lakewood, did you build this house? Did you have it built?
No.
Or was it
actually,
here?
Actually, we are the third owners.
When was it built?
It was built in 1930, approximately, during that period. It was built by a doctor. It's in that thing that I gave you.
Okay.
One on, but anyway, it was built by a doctor, Harry B. Stone, Sr. They had six children, but they were all, the youngest was, probably 7 or 8. Most of them were teenagers. I think maybe 2 of them were in college at the time. And they lived here from 1930 until, I believe, 1951. It was bought then by a businessman, Gretton Lindsay, and his wife, and they lived here. They had one child, and they lived here until we bought it in April. We moved in here April 1st, 1961, with our 4 children. The oldest at that time would have been 16. Bobby would have been 16, the son, and Teresa would have been 6. Yeah. 6.
And you have a special name for the house. Can you explain how you why you gave it the name you did?
It's taken from the name of the 4th and the 3rd child. T-E-R, Teresa. A-N-I-T-A, Anita. Ter Anita.
Okay.
They lived here the longest. Not that we thought any less of the 2 older children, but as I said, Teresa was, she would have been 6, and Anita would have been 8, I guess, let's see, 61, yeah, 8, yeah, she would have been 8, but I named it after them. It sounded good, Tara Anita.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, of course, Terra, Latin, T-E-R-R-A, that's what it's for, land, isn't it? And that's Latin for land.
I think
but
so.
Anyway, it didn't, her name is T-E-R, then Ter Anita, so it went together well. Yeah.
Those are basically the questions I had to ask you. Do you have more that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I was
us?
Just, I was going some of the things that I some of these things. I was just thinking of things as I was. Well, here's some trivia. Like, I remember in that block of Camel Avenue from Jefferson Street to First Street or Henry Street, in the 30s, there were 5 and 10 cent store in that one block. There was Woolworths, S.H. Kress, McClellan's, W.T. Grant, and another one called Schulte United. But I remember just things that come to you. I don't know whether you wouldn't remember, of course. I'm sure you had a yo-yo. Well, this was when they first came out. It was really a fad. And I can remember S.H. Kress had this Filipino demonstrating a yo-yo down in the basement of S.H. Kress.
There was a mob of people. This was really a fad during that period. It would have been sometime, probably about 33 or 34. I was just a small child. But I remember going there, I could hardly see because so many people. This guy was there demonstrating, throwing his yo-yo around. And that sort of thing just came to my mind.
Did you get a yo-yo?
Oh, yeah,
that?
I got a yo-yo. It was
Were you good at it? 10 cents.
No, I don't think I would be considered good at it. But this guy, he could, I can remember him throwing that thing around. He was throwing it all kinds of directions. And then, oh, it must have been 100 people there in the basement. They were in the basement. See, they had two floors. They had the basement. I think it had a few toys in there. And then he had a lunch counter upstairs. And that was something that came to my mind. Another thing that came to my mind was the Woolworth store, which was on across the street. In fact, you may have been here when it finally closed. It closed about 10 years ago. Were you here then?
No. Yeah. My husband was here, though.
Yeah. It was on the south side of Camel Avenue. Anyway, it was approximately in the middle of the block. It was up from the bank there. Five or six stores up in the back. I remember in the summer, it must have been 34 or 35. They were the first store that had air conditioning. Walked in that store in the hot summer. It was like going into a refrigerator. I mean, you know, it's the first time you'd ever been in air conditioning building. Here you went from 90 degrees outside to inside. It felt like you were in heaven almost. The Woolworth store. That was the first air conditioning I can remember.
So was it popular because they had air conditioning?
They had a lunch counter in there. And each counter, in those days, each counter had a sales clerk. Each counter. Then they had this big lunch counter. I think it occupied the entire side of it. They had a lot of business there. But each counter they had, a whole big display of this loose candy. You could go in there and buy a nickel's worth of candy. They'd dip it out of these display cases. So that, I remember that because it was so, it was something you just couldn't believe almost. You know, you're used to going, like all my father's drugstores, all they had was these ceiling fans. You'd go in, it'd be 85 or 90 degrees, you know, in the summertime. I remember, and you may have had this come up, President Roosevelt. Have you had it come up?
Mm-hmm. Okay. No.
He took office in March of 33. They had built the Veterans Administration Hospital up here. And he came, I believe it was in the fall, I'm not sure, of 34. But anyway, he was going to dedicate the building of the hospital. So they even let the schools out. So he was, his traveling, his schedule called him for him to come up Grandin Road. But we live just one block over on Belleville. So when he came in, he had this open car. He drove right up Grandin Road. We were out on the corner of Grandin and Shirley right there. And we waved at him. It was the first president I'd ever seen in my life.
Was it a big procession?
As I remember, it was a group of cars. Mm-hmm. And he was going up to the veterans. But then my parents took us, and I think my brother, my older brother, up to the Veterans Administration, where he gave the speech and the dedication. Oh, it was thousands of people. And we were below where he was speaking, and they were speaking from a platform, and all the crowd was out below there. And we went there and saw him speak. But that was the first president I'd ever seen. And I was, in my lifetime, I was counting them last night, I have, there have been 15 presidents since I was born. He was, I've only seen, let's see, Roosevelt, and I saw Nixon, I saw Carter, Reagan, but I think that's all I've ever seen. But I know Kennedy came here, but I didn't get to see him, and Eisenhower came here.
Wrong.
Yeah, both of them. And Reagan came to the Civic Center. I saw him there. He spoke. I saw Carter in Norfolk. Oh, I've seen George Bush, the first, the father. In fact, I was on council at the time. He was vice president. And I presented the key to the city to, he was vice president then. He may have been running for vice president at that time with Reagan. He wasn't president, though. Have you talked to anybody about the Thanksgiving celebrations here? Well, you haven't.
No.
Well, in those days, Thanksgiving was the outstanding holiday in Roanoke. I would say more so even than Christmas. And the reason for that was VMI and VPI met here for a football game on Thanksgiving Day. You weren't aware of this?
I actually had read an article about that only by doing other research.
Every year up until VPI got so VMI could not be competitive with them. I think up until about 71 or 72. Every year, when my brother was at VMI those 4 years, that's when we really got interested in it. But anyway, the cadets, in other words, they got no Thanksgiving holiday because of it, because they had what they call the Thanksgiving Day Classic, Victory Stadium was not there. They had wooden stands. No, they called it the Splinter Bowl. Anyway, the cadets would arrive here on Thanksgiving or in the morning.
Would they take the train down from Rockbridge?
The cadets from VPI came on the train, and I think the VMI cadets either came by bus or train, I've forgotten now, but I'm sure that the VPI cadets came by. And they assembled there at the Link Museum. It was an old railroad station in those days. But anyway, they would assemble there and in formation. And that time, VMI probably had less than 1,000 cadets. And VPI, they were much bigger. I would estimate they had between 2,000 and 3,000 cadets. Of course, this is before VPI. That was called Virginia Polytechnic Institute. And it was basically an agricultural school, and nothing like it is today. In fact, of course, no female cadets. And I don't think it even had any female students at that time. It may have been just the cadets' corps. But anyway, they would assemble there at the station. Then they would march up Jefferson Street. One or the other would go first. They would usually start around noon and march straight up Jefferson Street all the way across the Jefferson Street Bridge on out to where the Victory Stadium is. That's where the game was played. Then, of course, they had their band, and then the VMI cadets, or vice versa, they would march up Jefferson Street. Of course, all the streets were lined up watching them. They had their bands playing all during that period. And, it was quite a, on every corner, these vendors were selling VPI, VMI colors, where people put the team that they were on their coat.
So and you voted for, you were rooting for VMI?
VMI, yeah, right. And my brother, then the game was, I think, 2 or 2:30. And VPI usually won. And after the game, because my brother was a student, he would usually invite three or four of his best friends and their girlfriends after the game to come to our house, where my mother would serve them, a turkey dinner. We'd have the whole house full of cadets and their girlfriends for Thanksgiving dinner.
Did you go to the games?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always went to the games.
I've seen pictures where the women would get dressed in their fur coats and their gloves.
Yeah.
So it was a fancy event. You got dressed up in your best clothes.
It was a tremendous event. I would say, and those, they had to put up special bleachers. In other words, that was before the Victory Stadium. See, the Victory Stadium didn't come in until after, I think, 41. But anyway, it was a tremendous event. I remember we would gather there at the Patrick Henry Hotel under that marquee, and because it was a little warmer there. And sometimes it was Thanksgiving. I can remember one Thanksgiving. It snowed, and they played in the snow out there. And that was, tremendous. And then that night, they would have dances. The Cotillion, the German Club, would have dances at Hotel Roanoke or the Hotel Patrick Henry. And, it was a tremendous event. And a lot of out-of-town people would come to Roanoke during that period. But that holiday was, I think in those days, probably considered more of a holiday than Christmas was.
Was that your favorite holiday then?
Well, I guess it probably was. But we always had good Christmas. Christmas in those days, fireworks was one of the main things during the Christmas. They had sky rockets and Roman candles. But I can remember sleeping there on the sleeping porch on Christmas Eve night. And, you'd hear fireworks going off all night long throughout. You could hear them. And, of course, you were anxious to get up and go downstairs for Christmas, that was, Thanksgiving was a very big holiday for Roanoke. It was because of the game, and so many of the alumni of VPI and VMI both lived in Roanoke. Am I boring you too much?
No, I'm enjoying it. I hope you're doing okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, we were talking about streetcars. I remember the last streetcar in Roanoke. And as I told you, our store was on the corner of one of the downtown stores on the corner of Jefferson Salem Avenue. The last streetcar in Roanoke, that night around 11 o'clock, our store stayed open late. The last streetcar, it was during the summer because I was home from college, left there right, the end of the streetcar line was right where the railroad tracks are now, right there at Jefferson Street, right beyond Salem Avenue. So all the city officials, being the last streetcar in Roanoke, this would have been, I think, in 48, the summer of 48. So we were open at the drugstore, and I remember going out there on the curbside, and they had all the city officials, the mayor, and city manager, so they all left and went out Jefferson Street to the car barn, which was under the Walnut Street Bridge. I can remember that because we were there and watched it, the last streetcar in Roanoke.
Was it disappointing when the streetcar system stopped?
Well, I think it had a lot of nostalgia, you know, and but the problem with streetcars, they weren't as flexible as a bus, you know. Bus can go like a car.
So really the bus system replaced the streetcar system?
But, gosh, we had, an excellent streetcar transportation system. It went all out through South Roanoke, the all out Grandin Road. The end of the line was right there at Patrick Henry High School. Came on down Grandin Road, Memorial Avenue, Patterson Avenue down into town. They had all down southeast, up the, to northeast there where my father's drugstore, streetcar turned there, went up that hill on over into where the Civic Center is now. That was, but they ran until midnight. It really had excellent service. And you got to remember that most of the transportation in those days was done on streetcars because so few people had cars. So a person that had no car, that's the only way they could travel. If you wanted to go to a movie downtown or anything like that, or shopping, You'd have to catch a streetcar.
I've heard people talk about maybe bringing it back. Do you think it would do well, or do you think it would be
I just don't think it'd be practical. I don't. I can remember when we had them, we would go down Campbell Avenue, and there were cars parked on both sides. So if you got behind a streetcar, you just had to follow it until it turned or you turned. You would just have to follow it because you couldn't pass, you know, because the streets are that narrow. And in that period, they allowed parking on both sides of Campbell Avenue. So you had double streetcar tracks and parking on both sides, so you couldn't go around.
So it would hold up traffic.
Yeah, if you got behind a streetcar, you just had to go with them. And they did provide real good service, like Grandin Road, all out to seemed like it went Avonham, all out through South Roanoke, southeast, went up Dale Avenue. And you live in Vinton, don't you? You still live?
I actually live on Reed Mountain.
Oh, you do?
At the very tip of
Then you used to live
city.
In Vinton.
My husband's from Vinton.
Oh, yeah, maybe that's where. Oh, yeah, I know exactly where Reed Mountain is. But, the streetcars were a lifesaver in those days because so few people had cars, particularly in the beginning when they first came here in Roanoke, which I think was around 1912 along in there. So the automobile didn't become popular until really the 30s and the 40s. When I had the drugstore and we opened the Gaslight restaurant, which was on the second floor, we did, I think that I was the first one that ever did this on TV. I did my own TV ad. And this was a Gaslight restaurant, so it was, the decor was of that period. It had red velvet, beautiful restaurant. And so when we first opened it, we, of course, wanted to advertise and make it known. So I got my, Anita played the piano. And Teresa, the younger girl, she played the bass fiddle, which is in the dining room there now. And so I got a red, pink and white sport coat and a sailor, one of the sailor's cap, straw hats, flat, you know, was, I think you call them sailor. So I wanted to do an ad to attract people to the Gaslight restaurant. So we, I think it opened in the summer is the way it happened. And so they played the piano and the bass fiddle, and I sang in the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, Garland's is the place to dine in the good old summertime. And the kids, of course, they were just small, you know, and they were on TV, and all their playmates, they were so proud of that. But that was, as far as I can remember, I think it was the first TV was ever done by unprofessional. Oh yeah, we had all the business we could take care of. They would line up. The Gaslight would seat about 65 people, but we'd have to turn people away a lot of the meals. Couldn't. They would wait and the lines would be too long. They would go elsewhere. But I can remember that. I wish that I had gotten a tape of that, but I didn't.
No.
And I don't want to keep you too long here.
No, you're fine. I'm fine as long as you're fine.
Oh, I was telling you about the Rialto Theater. That was, you know where the center of the square is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Rialto Theater, in fact, that's in this article that you'll read about. The Rialto Theater was right, seemed like it was be a little further up towards Jefferson Street. Anyway, that was a Western movie. And, of course, as a young boy in those days, those cowboy movie stars were very popular. They were our heroes, you might say. So we would go there. My brother or some friends would go there just about every Saturday and see the cowboy movie. And then after we saw the movie, my mother would give us enough money to see the movie. Gave us two tokens for the streetcar ride. Then we would go from the movie, after the movie was over, we'd go down to the Ronald Wiener stand, which is five or six stores down where the ride.
Where it is still now?
Yeah, where it is okay. Now. And we would go in there and get a hot dog and a Coca-Cola. And boy, that was
a day out on the town.
10 cents.
Wow.
10 cents for Coca-Cola and a hot dog. And man, it was really good. And then we would, sometimes I would go on, we would go down to my father's drugstore and maybe hang around down there some. Or we would go back right on the streetcar and go back home. But that was almost every Saturday afternoon. We would see a cowboy movie and go to the Roanoke Wiener Stand. And we thought that was really something. Now, what does a hot dog cost down there?
Oh, gosh. For a hot dog, soda, and a,
what,
I think
it be,
a fries,
$2?
No, I think it's $5.25 is the cost kidding. For it. Yeah.
10 cents.
Oh, wow.
In the 30s.
And $5.25 is actually pretty good for that nowadays.
Well, I think I've... Oh, and in those days, any rain of 1 inch or more would almost always flood the downtown area. Mm. My father's drugstore would invariably get flooded. As I pointed out in this, it's a picture of me in the Roanoke paper of us trying to keep the water out of the drugstore or with mops and all. Mm. And but that was... Oh, practically every summer. I remember one summer, the water had gotten up to where the windows on streetcars were. Streetcars would be in the middle of Campbell Avenue, and the water would get up to that point, which would be at least 4 or 5 feet. But see, it was the sewage, the drainage system, they just didn't have any in those days to speak of. Any rain of several inches would flood the complete downtown area. My father took us to the first All-Star baseball game, which was in Chicago.
Oh.
And that was in 1933. And that was, Babe Ruth hit a home run. I would have been 10 years old at the time. And the American League won 4-2. My father was a great baseball fan, and at the same time, that was in July of 1933, the World's Fair was there at that time in Chicago. So we got to see the All-Star game, the first All-Star game, and then when we went to the Chicago World's Fair several days.
Wow.
After that. And we also saw some baseball games, Wrigley Field. But that game was at Comiskey Park.
Was Babe Ruth a big hero?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he had a home run in that game.
Wow. Did you watch the local baseball team? Was there a local baseball team?
It was a local baseball team, and I went to some of the games.
Where was
called
that?
Called the Roanoke. It was at the fair, they call it the fairgrounds, which you, where they... Victory Stadium, that was
okay.
All. The baseball field, as I remember, was at this end of the Franklin Road area, beyond that, on Reserve Avenue. It was called the Roanoke Red Sox.
Oh.
And that was the name of the team. But Roanoke has never been except for that Thanksgiving Day game, they've never been one to support sports very much. You know, they've had failures, football teams, hockey, basketball team. I don't know what it is. And same thing happened to that. It just that was part of the Piedmont League, like Norfolk, Roanoke, I think Lynchburg was in it, Durham, North Carolina. It was the Piedmont League, and they were in that particular league.
Was it a minor league? Okay.
It was a minor league. It would be similar to what Salem is now.
Okay.
I would say it'd be on the same par as the Avalanche, and that's what they call them, mm-hmm. Avalanche. I think it'd be on the same. And they had that, I know after the war, for I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years, I would think. But the attendance was such as they just couldn't support it. Hmm. It didn't have enough fans to support it.
That's too bad.
Let me take you down to the basement while you're here.
Okay.
I have some things there that you might be interested in.
Okay.
I think I covered all of this. I hope I haven't gone too long here.
No, not at all. Thank you, Mr. Garland, for letting us interview you.
I want to sign this to a